The Clash of the Two Americas, Volume 1, The Unfinished Symphony, was written by Matthew Errett and Cynthia Chung and published by the Canadian Patriot Press. This recording is narrated by Hugh Patrick Trudeau. Chapter 5, History as a Warfare, the 1619 Project and the Plot to Destroy the Republic. Repression is the only lasting philosophy. The dark deference of fear and slavery, my friend, will keep the dogs obedient to the whip as long as this roof shuts out the sky. Words of the Marquis Saint-Evremond from Dickens's Tale of Two Cities. A major cultural fight has broken out between two opposing philosophical schools, which have been at war with each other since the earliest days of the U.S. Republic's birth in 1776. On the one hand, Donald Trump's now disbanded 1776 Commission had attempted to revive a lost practice of teaching American history as though the United States were a good thing in world history, while on the other hand, the New York Times' 1619 Project invoked a method that saw only evil in America's 250-year experience. While the former president's commission was designed to promote patriotic history, it naively painted over some glaring hypocrisies of American history by placing figures like Hamilton, Jackson, Jefferson, and Lincoln in the same boat, thus keeping a bit too much bathwater along with the baby. Despite this fact, it did represent an important cultural battle over the soul of America, which is now sitting precariously on the edge of a new civil war and economic disintegration. What is the 1619 Project? The New York Times' 1619 Project, which was unveiled in June 2019 by Nicole Hannah-Jones, attempts to smear the entirety of American history as a one-dimensional, slave-promoting fraud from the moment the first slave arrived in Jamestown in 1619. During its short existence, this project has quickly won over thousands of academics and, in spite of its proven fallacies, which it had to cover secretly in Orwellian fashion, Jones was still awarded the Pulitzer Prize, legitimizing the fraud in the minds of countless school administrators, policymakers, and academics. If one truly accepts the claims of the 1619 Project, which have been turned into a Pulitzer curriculum and are already embedded in 4,500 U.S. schools, then America's disillusion would be no great loss to the world. In fact, one would have to conclude that since the Republic was always built upon the defense of slavery, going so far as to paint the British Empire as an anti-slavery bastion, which the Founding Fathers broke away from only due to their fear of having their slaves removed, then America was always evil. The first paradox. If it were true that the creation of the American Republic was simply driven by a desire to protect the institution of slavery from the abolition-loving British, then it should be asked, why did every American state shut down the African slave trade by 1793? Hard to believe? Let the facts speak for themselves. By 1784, six states in the new nation had voted to totally abolish slavery: Rhode Island in 1774, Vermont in 1777, Pennsylvania in 1780, Massachusetts in 1781, New Hampshire in 1783, and Connecticut in 1784. While the importation of new slaves was banned by every other state by 1793. The important Northwest Ordinances, passed in the 1787 Continental Congress, ensured that no slavery would be permitted in the immense Northwest Territories, giving rise to the later addition of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin as free states. This agreement was established during the 1774 Continental Congress, where a non-importation act was signed by all colonies, saying that we will neither import nor purchase any slave imported after the first day of December next, after which time we will wholly discontinue the slave trade, and will neither be concerned in it ourselves, nor will we hire our vessels, nor sell our commodities or manufactures to those who are concerned in it. Another paradox. If Britain was threatening to end the slave trade, as the 1619 Project authors teach, then why did the Empire override dozens of petitions from the colonies between 1650 and 1765, demanding an end to slavery? Rather than oppose slavery, the British Royal Africa Company, under the direction of the Privy Council and the Board of Trade, enforced the importation of 8 million African slaves into the Americas during the 18th century alone. Between 1630 and 1765, these same organizations constantly strove to destroy all efforts to establish manufacturing within the colonies, which everyone knew was the only effective pathway to liberating a society from reliance on slave labor. Additionally, if it were true that the 1776 revolution was driven by the intent to protect the slave economy from the freedom-loving British Empire, then why did England only ban slavery in 1807? And why did they wait until 1833 to begin extending this ban across their colonies? Did the Founding Fathers have a crystal ball and act on events that would occur only 65 years in the future? If the British truly hated slavery so much, then why did the Empire maintain a global system of subjugation, famine, and exploitation across Asia, Ireland, and beyond for so many generations? So what happened? Was the British Empire seriously pushing an anti-slavery agenda? Why did America's anti-slave trajectory fall apart so soon after the revolution? And why did the rot spread to the point of necessitating a civil war by 1861? How to proceed with a serious investigation? The matter of money. Since one of the most effective keys to understanding history starts with the question of who controls the money, economics is a good place to start. Approaching the matter this way will cause the inquiring mind to confront the battle between the two opposing paradigms of statecraft that defined the world in which the American Revolution arose as part of an international phenomenon involving leaders from Russia, France, Germany, Ireland, Spain, India, and Morocco. The battle over what sort of system of economics would govern America after political independence was achieved in 1783 will become here a very valuable question. While certain players of that age believed that value should be locked into rules of money worship and profit, which all people desired since money bought pleasure and helped us avoid pain, others disagreed and believed value should be looked for elsewhere. These others believed that value transcended matters of pleasure and pain and touched upon something less transient and more universal. But what? Benjamin Franklin's revolutionary conception of value. During the 18th century, these latter forces centered themselves around the figure of America's father of founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin, who drafted some of the most important policies that led to the sovereign control over currency from his 1729 On the Necessity for a Paper Currency and onwards. Franklin used his powerful printing presses to spread both sovereign banking and anti-slavery pamphlets, books, and treatises for decades before the revolution itself was declared in 1775. One of the most powerful anti-slavery books printed by Franklin was the influential 1737 All Slave Keepers Who Keep the Innocent in Bondage by Benjamin Lay, which argued that any Christian keeping slaves was an offense against God. Lay wrote, "No greater sin hell can invent than to profane and blaspheme the pure and holy truth which is God all in all, and remove God's creatures made after his own image from all the comforts of life and their country, and bring them into all the miseries that dragons, serpents, devils, and hypocrites can procure and think of." In the mind of Franklin and his co-thinkers, these issues, economics and slavery, represented two sides of the same fight. Franklin argued in his many writings that value originated in what you create that satisfies the needs of humanity, and not what things you possess or wish to consume. Since a society of creators and producers requires a sovereign manufacturing to generate real wealth, and constant internal improvements of infrastructure to coordinate the development of all parts of a nation under a unified intention, Franklin recognized clearly that the production generated by slave labor is a chimera and actually represented a form of anti-value. Like heroin consumption today, anti-value simply means any form of momentary profit that might even be measurable as GDP and generate money flows, but actually represents a destruction of that society's ability to sustain its own existence over time. The reason for this is simple. Slavery destroys the creative powers of mentation in both the laboring slaves, who are valued only for their animal labor, and also in the decadent slave master, whose potential for creativity becomes narrowly defined by ways to keep the slaves under control. It is thus no coincidence that Franklin also created the Anti-Slavery Alliance in the 1760s and later founded the 1785 Society for Promoting the Manumission of Slaves, alongside several of his devoted protégés. These protégés included the figures of Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and Governor Morris, who all happened to become the creators and leaders of the American system of political economy, premised on the use of a national bank, productive credit, protective tariffs, and large-scale manufacturing to promote the economic sovereignty of the new nation. The society's founding constitution read, "The benevolent creator and father of all men, having given them all an equal right to liberty, life, and property, no sovereign power on earth can justly deprive them of either, but in conformity to impartial government and laws to which they have expressly or tacitly consented." One of Franklin's leading British collaborators was Josiah Wedgwood, a leader in the Lunar Society, who sent Franklin copies of a medallion produced in his ceramic factory, featuring a black slave in bondage, exclaiming, "Am I not a man and a brother?" Replying to Wedgwood, Franklin stated that the image may have an effect equal to that of the best written pamphlet in procuring favor to those oppressed people, and proceeded to spread the design across the new nation as a battle cry for abolition. When Jefferson took control of the presidency from 1801 to 1809, a major victory was won for the pro-slavery oligarchs of America, who saw immense profits to be gained by spreading their peculiar form of society under a perverse form of manifest destiny. Admittedly, these oligarchs would have been much happier with the election of Aaron Burr to the presidency in 1801, since an immediate dissolution of the Union would have occurred between slave and free states as early as 1804. Unlike Burr, Jefferson was at least against breaking up the Union into Northern and Southern confederacies, with the free states merging with Canada and the slave states becoming their own nation. And that is why Hamilton, Jefferson's political nemesis, ironically organized aggressively for his victory, winning the fatal ire of Burr. Sadly, Jefferson's devout belief in agrarianism, hate for manufacturing, love of slavery, and British Enlightenment thinking still made him an instrument for the slave power's cancerous growth during much of his terms in office. The British Empire's global game. By destroying Indian textile production and subduing the Chinese dragon with a program of mass opium consumption that would stain the 19th century, the city of London quickly took control of world textile manufacturers, thus creating a primary export market for southern slave plantation cotton, and leading to a new addiction, the addiction to the easy money derived from cheap slave labor. This proto-globalization established a global closed system of controls onto all nations through cash cropping, free trade, speculation, and drugs. By 1840, over 20% of the British population was employed in textiles, working in inhumane conditions, as Charles Dickens described in his Tale of Two Cities and other writings. The best of times and the worst of times. With the 1804 murder of Hamilton by Burr, and the undermining of America's national credit system between 1804 and 1836, British free trade grew as protective tariffs were taken down, and credit towards infrastructure projects like the Erie Canal, roads, rail, etc. shriveled up. Speculation ran rampant whenever this monetarist system was unleashed, driven by booms and busts, and the rise of states' rights programs that superseded all national initiatives. This process was taken directly from classic divide-to-conquer tactics that had already been used by empires for millennia. An astute American Whig economist, looking upon this bipolar process in America, while comparing it to the depressingly stagnant Canadian economic situation of 1791-1850, stated in 1853, "Though the ratio of the increase of the population has been greater in Canada than in the United States, yet their increase of wealth has barely kept pace with the population, and they are as poor as they were half a century since. They have enjoyed the blessings of free trade with England all the time. We have only a part of the time. Whenever we have attempted to supply ourselves by our own industry with the comforts and necessaries of life, we have improved our condition as a people. And during the intervals of free trade and large importations of foreign goods, we have relapsed again into a condition bordering on bankruptcy. While the Canadians have been constantly exhausted and kept so poor by free trade as to be unable to get sufficient credit to have even the ups and downs of prosperity and bankruptcy in succession." The slave power spreads. By 1836, the Second National Bank was officially killed after a mass propaganda campaign convinced a duped mob that it was an instrument of tyranny in America. And over the coming six decades, the only five presidents who would make any serious effort towards reviving America's nationalist banking system would end up dead while in office: Harrison in 1841, Taylor in 1850, Lincoln in 1865, Garfield in 1880, and McKinley in 1901. Andrew Jackson, the man who is today celebrated for having killed the bank and paying off America's debts, was in reality a force of pure destruction. Jackson paid the debt by cutting all infrastructure projects and unleashing mass speculation, which resulted in a devastating 1837 bank panic that drove the nation into discord and depression. An unrepentant racist, Jackson also gave enormous assistance to the slaveocracy by emptying the southern lands of Cherokee in the genocidal Trail of Tears and giving the land over to cotton-planting oligarchs loyal only to their profits, way of life, and the British Empire. This story is told in all of its ugly detail in historian Michael Kirsch's groundbreaking 2012 study, How Andrew Jackson Destroyed the United States. Between 1801 and 1840, Southern cotton exports exploded from 100,000 bales per year to 1 million bales per year, with 80% of the exports going to Britain. The City of London, Wall Street, New Orleans Triangle dominated the world system, with New Orleans representing over 12% of all U.S. banking capital. The southern slave states grew to represent the world's fourth biggest economy through the support of the British Empire, both financially and also in the logistical support needed to import mass slavery into the Americas. This degeneration proceeded slowly until the presidencies of Jackson and his handler, Martin Van Buren. But after this, cotton exports increased to 4 million bales per year by 1860, and the slave power grew immensely under the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 that ensured the spread of slavery west of the Mississippi River. While many radical abolitionists in the USA and British Canada then advocated for the dissolution of the Union as an alternative to civil war, stronger souls like Frederick Douglass recognized the higher historic fight at hand. As a lesson to modern anarchists who believe in the 1619 Project and feel no sorrow at the burning of America under a new civil war today, Douglass took the time to research history and broke with William Lloyd Garrison, the leader of the abolitionist movement, defending the Constitution in 1852. I differ from those who charge this baseness on the framers of the Constitution of the United States. It is a slander upon their memory. In that instrument, the U.S. Constitution, I hold there is neither warrant, license, nor sanction of the hateful thing. But interpreted as it ought to be interpreted, the Constitution is a glorious liberty document. Read its preamble, consider its purposes. Is slavery among them? Is it at the gateway? Or is it in the temple? It is neither. While I do not intend to argue this question on the present occasion, let me ask, if it be not somewhat singular that, if the Constitution were intended to be, by its framers and adopters, a slave-holding instrument, why neither slavery, slaveholding, nor slave can anywhere be found in it. This higher understanding of history and the principles of the Constitution caused Douglass to ally himself with Lincoln, where he worked with all his might to recruit 200,000 black soldiers to Lincoln's cause. Later in life, Douglass attacked British free trade and cheap labor in defense of the nationalist system, writing in 1871, "Cheap labor is a phrase that has no cheering music for the masses. Those who demand it and seek to acquire it have but little sympathy with common humanity. It is the cry of the few against the many. When we inquire, who are the men that are continually vociferating for cheap labor? We find not the poor, the simple and the lowly, not the class who dig and toil for their daily bread, not the landless, feeble and defenseless portion of society, but the rich and powerful, the crafty and the scheming, those who live by the sweat of other men's faces." The British hand behind the Civil War. During the entirety of the Civil War, the British Empire's guiding hand could always be felt, from supplying the South with battleships, weapons, and finances, to providing logistical and diplomatic support internationally. Even British Canada was given over to the Confederacy's intelligence headquarters, which deployed spying, money laundering, and terrorist operations against the Union during the entire war. Speaking to the British Parliament, Lord Robert Cecil, Marquis of Salisbury, expressed Britain's logic succinctly when he said in 1861, "The northern states of America never can be our sure friends because we are rivals, rivals politically, rivals commercially. With the southern states, the case is entirely reversed. The population are an agricultural people. They furnish the raw material of our industry, and they consume the products which we manufacture from it. With them, every interest must lead us to cultivate friendly relations. And when the war began, they at once recurred to England as their natural ally." Before we explore the role of British arsonists stoking the fires of secession and civil war in the USA, let us take a little bit more time to explore the early founders of the American system and the pre-Civil War struggles between the two Americas.